you send advance agents or advance deputies to the location to, you know, scout the hotels, scout the routes, scout the hospitals.
Planning security for a high-level official like President Obama. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 24th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, Sitka sits on a different piece of Earth than the rest of Alaska.
We have been working very hard over the years to try to figure out which other continent they are tied to.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Governor Bill Walker says he plans to recommend to legislators that the state buy out TransCanada Corporation's position in the major liquefied natural gas project that Alaska is pursuing. Under an agreement that predates Walker's administration, TransCanada would hold the state's interest in the pipeline and gas treatment plant, with the state having an option to buy back a portion of that interest. It's been cast as a way for the state to not have to bear as much upfront costs as it would without TransCanada involved. But the agreement also allows the state to terminate the partnership, though the state would have to reimburse TransCanada for its development costs. Walker said the pipeline is an important project and the state needs to be more involved in it. Alaska and the future of Arctic policy are seeing increased international attention as the U.S. holds the chairmanship for the Arctic Council and foreign ministers prepare to meet in Anchorage later this month, joined by President Obama. International leaders were in Bethel last week when the Inuit Circumpolar Council Executive Council met to plan their next few years of work. Jim Stotz of Barrow is president of ICC Alaska. He says the indigenous perspective needs to be heard at the high-level meetings.
But I don't think things can really happen in the Arctic without the involvement of Inuit, the people that are living particularly on the coasts, the Arctic coast of North America. We are the ones that have lived there the longest, know the most about it. And if we're not included in any discussions about the Arctic, they're incomplete discussions as far as I'm concerned.
The ICC represents indigenous people from Arctic nations. They consult with the United Nations and are a permanent participant in the Arctic Council. The ICC's goals aim well beyond the president's visit, with summits on economic development, wildlife management, and education planned for the next few years. Officials say they want to strengthen the ICC's role within the international sphere. ICC Vice Chair Hjalmar Dahl is ICC President for Greenland. He emphasized that indigenous leaders need to reach out to all generations across the North and connect them with those goals and common interests.
We are not isolated people. We are part of the global community. So it's important for us also to get the youth, get knowledge on our work on that area, also that the youth be interested also.
The Executive Council also took a trip to the nearby village of Oscarville to see a pilot project for coordinated and collaborative community development. The White House released more details today on President Obama's visit to Alaska next week. The president will spend Monday in Anchorage, Tuesday in the Seward area, and Wednesday in Dillingham and Kotzebue. Planning the security for Obama's visit isn't easy, according to retired Federal Marshal Mark Otte. For 22 years, the Eagle River resident helped protect foreign dignitaries and federal judges. He told APRN's Lori Townsend there is no detail too small when advanced agents are scouting for a trip for high-level officials, especially the president.
You'll go in and in certain cases, you may do complete backgrounds on all the workers in the hotel that are going to go in, and then those people will have a small credential, and they're the only people that can go in and out of the hotel room to clean it. Generally, on a high-profile dignitary, there's always an agent posted in the room, so no one ever goes in there unaccompanied. But all those things, from simple things like getting the elevator key so that when you're bringing your people, your detail arrives curbside when they're going up to their room or to any event, you can have the elevator waiting for them, and so they're not waiting in an area that's a kind of a choke point where there's danger in that area. So you, as an advanced agent or advanced deputy, you become the expert in that area so that you know you can tell your boss, the people, the detail supervisor, what to expect. And that would be the initial planning. And then, again, before any move, then there'd be an advance agent at that site, so you're never going anywhere blind, all the way to knowing exactly where to park, so you don't have something embarrassing happen, like a limousine pull up and the door that your protectee is going to get out is right in front of a fire hydrant or a bollard, and then, you know, it doesn't open. And those things happen. They occur all the time.
We've heard that there have been visits to some rural Alaska communities in advance of the president coming here, and he's going to be visiting areas in rural Alaska. What would the advanced security people that go out to those remote locations, what are they looking for?
They'd be looking for the same sorts of things that they'd be looking for in the city, but really, because so few federal agents go out to the bush, they're just learning the area. We've taken some dignitaries out there with the Marshal Service when I was the chief here. And I remember when Justice Scalia came, for instance, and this isn't the bush, but just going down to Homer to tour around a little bit after the bar convention that he spoke at. The detail supervisor called me and said, "Hey, could you get a red cap to meet me at the Homer Airport to help with the luggage?" And I said, "You know, that's not going to happen at the Homer Airport. There's not that sort of thing here." So in reference to the president's visit, they're just going to learn what to expect. And they're experts at, they might, for instance, if he went to a coastal village, if we had a justice visiting that was under some sort of a threat, and he or she was going to be near a coastal village or, say, a southeast village, in the past we've talked to the Coast Guard and said, "Hey, could you hang around off site here if you're in the area, and communicate with them so that we knew we had another method to evacuate in case things went bad."
What do you think Anchorage citizens should know about what will be happening when the president is here? What should people know about his time in Anchorage?
When the president moves, things are, they want to move him from, no matter who the president is, they want to move him from point A to point B quickly. And of course, he dictates that, but the Secret Service and on any protective detail, the protectee, it's still a free country. They can do what they want to do. But the security experts will try to get the person from point A to point B to their destination as quickly as possible. With the president, in my experience with the details that I've been on where we worked alongside the Secret Service, side routes will be blocked. If he were to move down a highway, for instance, then there would be local police blocking every exit so you couldn't get on just during the term of the movement. And they really are good at what they do, and they try to clear the area as quickly as they can. But I feel, though I'm not privy to the specifics of this security plan, I feel pretty confident saying there'll be streets blocked, streets closed during certain times of the day and movements. And if I didn't have business in the area, then I would stay away from it. And that's kind of a problem with Anchorage, because there are places you can go and there's only one way to get there. So plan ahead, listen to the news, and I would just be patient.
Mark Addy is the retired chief deputy for the U.S. Marshals. Now he writes political espionage thrillers under the pen name Mark Cameron. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, working the front desk at the Brother Francis Shelter.
You're actually physically helping people, and they appreciate it right off the bat. And you can see it, you can feel it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
Sitka sits on a different chunk of the Earth's crust than the rest of Alaska. Decades of scientific research have led to a report and map showing where the fault lies. The new information expands scientists' understanding of what's going on beneath Alaska's surface. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Fly into Sitka on a reasonably clear day, and it's hard to miss its most prominent chunk of rock. Mount Edgecumbe Volcano rises 3,200 feet above sea level. Neighboring cinder cones from separate eruptions are also impressive. But it's only one of Baranoff Island's geologic features. Over the past 40 years, researchers have turned up some less obvious portions of what's below Southeast Alaska's landscape.
We now know that the geology on Baranoff Island and West Chichagof Island do not match the rest of Southeast Alaska.
Susan Carl is a research geologist for the U.S. Geological Survey in Anchorage. She and other scientists collaborated to research and create the new Baranoff map and accompanying reports.
We also have spent a lot of time trying to figure out where it came from, why it came, how it came, and when it came from wherever it came from before to where it is now.
Baranoff Island and part of its northern neighbor Chichagof Island sit atop their own block of the Earth's crust. It's one of many plates and blocks, as they're called, in motion around the world. It's slow going, taking millions and millions of years. Some crash into each other, others scrape edge to edge, and yet others just sit there, at least for now. So, Carl says, parts of what's Alaska made its way here from someplace else.
There are various pieces of other continents, and we have been working very hard over the years to try to figure out which other continent they are tied to.
Parts of Southeast Alaska appear to have come from Siberia and even the Ural Mountains, way on the other side of Asia. Some moved up the coast from points south. One of those is Baranoff Island. It sits between two long faults in Chatham Strait to the east and the Pacific Ocean to the west, but about halfway up its eastern side, a separate coastal crack called the Peril Strait Fault heads west. That fault separates Baranoff from just about everything else in the region. Geologists know this because they've charted the island's bedrock. They've found a huge chunk of granite and similar rock in a common formation called a batholith. But Carl says part of it is missing.
That batholith is cut in half, or cut off right in the middle, by the Peril Strait Fault. And the other half of it, and those old rocks, they're not there at all.
So, where is it? Geologists compared its makeup with rocks nearby, then farther away, then much farther away. The closest match was about 1,000 miles down the coast in western British Columbia.
The best fit that we have is on Vancouver Island.
Scientists say Baranoff's last contact with that island happened about 50 million years ago. Another match may be Haida Gwaii, formerly known as the Queen Charlotte Islands. They're off British Columbia's coast, about 300 miles to the southeast of Baranoff. Geologist Carl says that means Sitka and the whole island made a slow slide up the Pacific coast, and it's separate from Juneau or Ketchikan or any other part of Alaska. That knowledge, along with earlier findings, expands our view of the region's mineral makeup. Practically, that can show where there might be valuable metals, and it could help us understand where future earthquakes or even volcanoes might happen. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
Classes in Juneau started last Thursday, but some high school activities have been underway for weeks. This school year, the district has drastically cut funding for activities and athletics, leaving some parents paying hundreds of dollars more for their kid to participate. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Michelle Norman has two kids at Thunder Mountain High School. Her daughter is on the swim and dive team. At the first parent meeting for the activity, she was asked to pay
an activity fee of $600. and approximately $150 travel fee for each meet out of Juneau.
Last year, Norman paid $275. She says this higher fee struck her as ridiculous. So Norman did her own research on travel costs to meets in Ketchikan and Sitka and says the $600 activity fee only makes sense if her daughter qualifies for state competition.
My daughter has a good chance of qualifying for state, and I expect, you know, if that happened, that I'd contribute more. But I'm not comfortable with paying $600 now for a potential $200 expense.
According to Juneau School Board policy, individual activity fees for participation in travel must be approved by the activities director and the superintendent. For students who are in financial need, the district has a scholarship fund. Superintendent Mark Miller says he hasn't approved any activity fees.
To my knowledge, we do not have actual individual fees.
Miller doesn't call the costs put on students or parents fees.
Different sports are going about fundraising in different ways, and some are asking for contributions from participants in order to limit or defray the amount of fundraising.
Thunder Mountain High School Activities Director Jake Jacoby says every fall sport does have an activity fee.
This is an individual activity fee that varies from activity to activity, and it's very low for activities that have low budget needs, and it is pretty darn high for the more expensive program.
He says $600 for the swim and dive team isn't the highest. The coaches come up with the fees, and Jacoby approves them, but he hasn't taken them to the superintendent. Jacoby says the fees go toward gear and travel, but the cost shouldn't be coming out of pocket.
There are fundraising opportunities that need to be provided by the teams in order for students to raise the money.
In an email from the Swim and Dive Booster Board at Thunder Mountain High School, parents were instructed to, quote, bring your checkbook to an August 4th meeting. The main fundraising event is selling Christmas trees, and parents were asked to think of other ideas. Due to district budget cuts to activities, Jacoby says everyone, coaches, booster clubs, parents, activities directors, is working through a new process this year.
I have had conversations with various coaches within the last week about fundraising and funding, and we'll continue to do so as all teams figure out what this means as far as funding all of their own travel.
Superintendent Miller says in the past, the district covered the majority of travel for high school activities.
Unfortunately, we've been dipping into the bank in order to cover those costs, and our bank account ran dry last year. And so this is really the first year that we've had to say we can't go over what we've allocated under any circumstance, and we can't allocate what we used to.
Miller says the district has set aside $150,000 for potential travel to state competitions, travel that teams don't necessarily budget for because it's last minute. It's hard to say if that's enough money because it depends on how well teams do, which means there will likely still be fundraising post-postseason. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
When someone gets arrested, often the first thing they'll want to do is make a call. If it's to a lawyer or legal aid, no problem. However, if it's to friends, family, or an employer, it's more complicated. KRBD's Madeline Beck looks into Alaska's inmate telephone services.
When an inmate at the Ketchikan Correctional Center wants to place a call, there are some rules. They can call lawyers without cost or much restraint, but calls to family or employers are allowed in 15-minute time slots and on the jail's terms.
So what happens is an inmate wants to contact family. They give a list of numbers that they want to have on their approved list, and they're able to call out. And it's set up and it's designed only to be landlines.
That's KCC's Superintendent Jessica Matthews. She says this is a way to make sure possible victims are safe from harassment. While local calls around Ketchikan are free, Matthews says inmates' families have to pay for long-distance calls to their landlines through Securus, a company contracted through the state. What happens is an inmate can place one call to a long-distance landline. After that talk, the call's receiver, maybe a mom or significant other, gets a bill from Securus for the call and options to open a payable account for future calls. If they don't pay or can't pay, the prisoner can no longer call that number. Alaska's system is actually cheaper than in much of the United States, where Securus does not allow free local calls. But Alaska is one of the few places that doesn't allow calls from prisons to cell phones. Matthews says that's how the contract with Securus was written.
You know, there's glitches with that, and people circumvent the rules for that. But that's the way the system is set up. In the future, Securus wants to try to include cell phones in that process. But right now, the contract doesn't authorize that.
Alaska Department of Corrections spokeswoman Sherry Daigle said in a statement that DOC's procurement team and contract overseers are working on changing the contract between Alaska Public Correctional Facilities and Securus, but it may take time. In that time, no cell phone policy could disproportionately hurt those who are already having a hard time. A July 2014 Pew Research survey found that those with lower incomes and those in minority racial groups have a far greater possibility of having only cell phones instead of landlines. Assistant Public Defender Jay Hochberg says many in Ketchikan's jail are part of that group and couldn't afford a lawyer without public defenders.
The number in this community runs over 80%. Over 80% of folks will receive a public defender.
Hochberg also notes that most KCC inmates haven't been convicted and are presumed innocent.
The vast majority of folks at our local jail are pretrial. Across the state, I think it's about 50-50 at the moment, sentenced prisoners versus pretrial detainees. And all across America, it is slightly more than 50%, if you look at all state and local jails together, of folks who are in jail, not because they've been adjudicated or proved as wrongdoers, but because they simply are impoverished or otherwise don't have access to the cash bail.
KRBD reached out to Securus, but was unable to talk with a representative. The company did provide links on how to call the lower 48 from a prison sender to cell phones, but not much else. Matthew says if people don't want to pay the calling fees or don't want their family to have to pay them, it's best to just do it the old-fashioned way.
Generally, what we would encourage people to do is to come visit or to write. And they can certainly, you know, their family has access to a landline. There's always a landline somewhere. So they can certainly do that. And sometimes that's just the unfortunate consequence of being in custody.
Matthew says this system works here in Ketchikan, and she hasn't had too many complaints. But this could be because there's a fast turnover with an average 30-day stay at KCC. If inmates are convicted, they are usually sent to Juneau or Anchorage. There, they would still have to use Securus and would be under similar calling rules. They are also often away from home at that point, and most calls to family and friends will be charged. The new FCC maximum rates for those calls are 21 cents per minute for collect and 25 cents per minute for prepaid or debit calls. Reporting from Ketchikan, I'm Madeline Beck.
Guests at Brother Francis Shelter in Anchorage keep the place running. They clean the floors and lay out the mats. They wash the blankets and monitor the doors. But they're supported by a cadre of staff who try to keep the place organized and safe. Beyond the entrance to the shelter sits support staff member Amber Grace Ali, who registers guests to make sure they're accounted for. Last month, when I spent a night there, she finished her shift around midnight and chatted with me about why she took a second job at Brother Francis.
As tired as I am, it's good. It's good to be here. It's a humbling experience.
Tell me more about what makes it good.
I guess maybe the instant gratification, you know, like you're actually physically helping people and they appreciate it right off the bat, and you can see it, you can feel it. Yeah, that's the best part, I think.
9 months ago, Grace Lee was bored and needed a distraction from her personal life, so she asked to volunteer at the shelter. Instead, she was hired to work a weekend day shift when only a few people are allowed inside. Brother Francis is an emergency night shelter and only offers limited services during the day. She didn't have to open the doors to people who made her uncomfortable. But then she started working nights.
during the winter.
The foyer was full right off the bat. Tons of people came in. I mean, and they were drunk, intoxicated, belligerent, angry, violent. And it was like, it just was just overwhelming, I think, more than anything.
Grace Lee says the situation was tense at first because she's only 25 and much younger than most of the guests and the other staff members. And she's never experienced homelessness before, so she was seen as a complete outsider. But she kept working the night shift and building up trust.
You know, we treat them like humans and they respond well because, you know, so many people just yell at them all the time, or they get arrested on the side of the street, or, you know, CSP drags them off, or, and I mean, it's rough. It's the way that they're living is rough.
And she tries to greet everyone with smiles and questions about their day while hiding her own emotions.
I find when we start our shift and we're positive up at the front, then everything else runs a little smoother. I mean, these are our community. They know when you're having a bad day. They can tell any little sign of discomfort on your face, anything, and they just attack it.
That doesn't mean she's perfected her poker face. Grace Ali says she still relies on the program manager to help her process some of her emotions and stress.
Maybe it's the constant need. Someone always needs something, which it's part of the job. We understand it. But, you know, even if it's not, hey, I need a pair of socks, it's like, hey, can I talk to you? And then they come and they pour it out, pour their whole week out.
She listens and feels for them and sometimes goes home crying. But Grace Ali says it's worth it.
I mean, crazy things happen down here, things I never would have imagined in my entire life, just crime and, you know, driving home at night and people falling into the road in front of my car. You know what I mean? Like, it's just insanity, the things that happen. I never in my entire life would have ever imagined that I would do it. And the fact that I make it through it several times a week, it's like, it's rewarding. It really is rewarding.
She says, despite the chaos, some of their guests have huge hearts, and it keeps her coming back week after week. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Bethel, Lori Townsend in Anchorage, Madeline Beck in Ketchikan, and Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.